I'm Kay Firth Butterfield at the World Economic Forum.
And I'm Miriam Vogel with Equal AI. And this is In AI We Trust. Welcome back to this week's episode of In AI We Trust. Today, we are so pleased to be joined by Ili Bayraktari, President and CEO of the Special Competitive Studies Project. Prior to launching SCSP, Ili served as Executive Director of the National Security Commission on AI, and before that, served as Chief of Staff to the National Security Advisor, held a variety of leadership roles for former Deputy Secretary of Defense, and served as Special Assistant to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Ili first joined the Department of Defense in 2010 and served in the Office of the Undersecretary for Policy as a country director for Afghanistan and later India. Ili, thank you so much for joining us today. We are so excited to talk with you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Ili, so you've spent so much of your career focusing on pressing national security issues at the highest levels of government. When did AI first come across your radar as a national security issue, and how did it change the focus of your work?
Thanks, Miriam. And as I said, it's really an honor to be on your podcast. In 2018, I was spending some time at the National Defense University. It was like my year off, my sabbatical after my time at the White House. And so really at that time, so this is 2018, I worked for Bob Work, as you mentioned, who is a big AI supporter and proponent. And I think some of the first initiatives in the Department of Defense were really due to his passion and his belief that really AI is that transformative technology. And so finally at NDU, I had time to sit down, think, read, and learn. And I always wanted to read and learn more about AI, so I started digging more into that. 2018 also is a year where I think Congress created the National Security Commission on AI. Unbeknownst to me, I didn't know that Congress at that time was grappling with this idea and this issue. And I think, you know, in hindsight, you see that the reason why I created that commission was they saw two things happening at the same time. Number one is, you know, when you look at 2016, 2017, and 18, you see early signs of how big this technology is going to be. We had AlphaGo beating the best Go player in South Korea, AlphaGo developed by DeepMind out of London. You had, you know, early, so like sparks of AI from private sector companies out of Silicon Valley. So everything the members of Congress were seeing coming out of private sector about this technology gave them an indication that, you know, we are on the brink of a really transformative era that this technology is going to bring about. So we have to look at what implications this technology might have for national security. So that's why I think one trend that the members of Congress were seeing. The other one was really more of a concern. It was of concern that everything coming out of China, out of Beijing, was that they really understood the power of this technology. Whether it was from the leadership speeches at their annual party congresses, whether it was coming from the investments they were announcing, the companies that all of a sudden appeared to be national AI champions out of China. I think that was a cause of concern for our members of Congress. And so what they did is they created a commission, which I was asked to serve as the executive director. I'd like to highlight that, you know, the commission's purpose was really to look at AI implications for national security. So it wasn't a commission to look at implications for the economy, the society, and everything else. It was really to look at how can AI impact executing of our national security missions. And given my background, I was asked to serve, given where I was at that time in terms of like understanding that this technology is really gaining ground and prominence. I was really fortunate to serve in that commission for the next 2.5 years.
Well, I need to dig deeper into this commission. I'm sure most of our listeners are very familiar with NSCAI, but anyone who hasn't, and even those who are familiar, might not be aware of what a masterclass it is in how a commission is and should be run, in no small part thanks to your leadership as executive director. Whether you're looking at how well-resourced it was, which is, you know, somewhat unusual for a commission, how proactive it was, which also is not what government is always known for. It was both focused and targeted and expansive in its impact, as well as the legacy it left. So much of your work was translated into actual legislation, into reality. So when you were first starting off in this role, in this commission that was first of its kind in so many ways, but I'm sure you had precedent to learn from in some aspects of how it was developed. What was your initial end goal with the commission and how did you achieve it?
Yeah. No, thanks, Miriam. I mean, look, it's all team effort. I mean, I'm sure like every success really has a lot of people involved around it. I think, you know, in hindsight, a lot of things are clear, much clearer, I think, than when you're executing it. But we were fortunate, as you said, that we had a huge bipartisan support, number one. Number two is the resources dedicated to execute the mission, which I think are critically important when you embark on a journey like that. I was fortunate to really work for 15 commissioners that Congress appointed that represented like, I think, our whole of nation approach to this issue. We had private sector leaders from some of the major companies. We had leaders from the academic world. We had former high-ranking government officials that really understood the role and adoption of these technologies in government. So I think the stars were aligned for us to do the work we did. That's one. The second thing is, you know, in 2019-20, when we did most of our work, a lot of things changed in our country too. I think for good, to be honest. I remember when I worked in DOD, and there was this hesitation in Silicon Valley to work with federal government. There was this, I mean, hesitation is probably the best word to describe it. But in 2019-20, that dynamic completely changed. And so I think some of the successes I think we had is that we created, you know, a transparent process, a big tent approach. We reached out to all voices that have some kind of a say in the AI development, whether they were private sector people, academia, people that wanted our government never to use AI for the purposes of national security. So that was, I think, what made it successful, because we were able to crowdsource, in today's terms, really a lot of our work. And we had a small and nimble team here in Washington. Our commissioners served North Stars in terms of pointing us to where we should go, the framework on how we should think. Our departments and agencies were really open with us in terms of what they are doing with AI, what they were thinking about doing with AI, what are the challenges. As you know, Miriam, with your work with NIAC, all the challenges that our department agencies have in adopting this technology. And so, you know, I believe that the environment was really set for us to walk in, do the work you do as a commission, come up with some of the ideas that you can provide to Congress, to the executive branch. As you know, these recommendations become part of a larger narrative, larger discourse, political compromises. You know, sometimes there are no resources dedicated for some of the recommendations, so you have to wait for the right window to open for that. But I think as a country in that time and space, we were moving towards really understanding that we have to do something. We have to do something to really set us on the right foot for the future. Because I believe, and I'm sure you do, Miriam, having spent many, many hours with you, that this is the technology that will define the future. And how we position ourselves, both from like how we adopt it, how we use it, how we safeguard it, will matter for the generations to come. And so I think it was like we walked into a perfect, I would not call it a storm, but a perfect moment in which all the stars were aligned for our work to be really accepted.
Let's dig in a little bit deeper to that, because we had the perfect environment. And in some ways, environments changed a lot. While there's still a lot of interest in AI, it's taken many turns since you first started this conversation with SCAI. How do you think that your perspective about AI and its impact on national security as a benefit and a hindrance has changed since you first started this work? And are we closer as a nation to being AI ready?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Miriam. But I think the technology has also evolved rapidly since NSCI days. I mean, when you look, you know, before ChatGPT and after ChatGPT, I mean, probably this moment will be defined in history as something in which, you know, before ChatGPT, you had groups of people probably that were aware of this massive technology coming our way. But after ChatGPT release, I think now this has become a mainstream. So of course now, you know, the conversation is much broader. The discussions about the implications and the responsible use are much broader, much thorougher, much deeper than before ChatGPT moment. Before ChatGPT, you know, from where I was sitting with NSEI, we were looking at a couple of specific departments and agencies in Washington and what they were doing in their, like, what we call it, the islands of hopes with AI. And now almost all the departments and agencies, state level governance, federal level, Congress, executive branch, they're all talking about, you know, AI. In some ways, everybody's moving to adopt some kind of policies. We had massive policies adopted in the last 12 months, both here in Washington and in Brussels, when it comes to AI and how we were planning to use it for government purposes, right? And so I think that the narrative has completely changed now. I think AI has arrived. And I think now we just have to make sure that how we set ourselves in terms of policies, in terms of legislations, and actually in terms of funding, because, you know, like, a lot of things we talk require us spending additional resources, as you're aware of. Like, we need to make sure that accessibility of this technology is widely adopted. It's not just select few companies with select few groups of people have access to this technology. But if this is the technology that will change our society and our economy for the future, then we have to make sure that it is widely adoptable and widely accessible. And so the narrative has completely changed. I think now it's at the point in which it's rightfully in the position that I always was hoping it gets, because then it gets the attentions of politicians, decision makers, you know, academia, non-governmental groups. And so I think now we're in that moment in which we have to channel this energy and this focus towards something that is positive and good for the future.
Well, that is very encouraging. And it's so interesting to hear your personal experience with the trajectory that we've all been experiencing of the world waking up to AI. And I know that that's part of what led to your development of the new area where you're sitting, the new organization you're leading as president and CEO of the Special Competitive Studies Project. I want to make sure to do a few things. First of all, to drill down, I know the fun thing about talking with you, Illy, is you don't just have pie in the sky ideas. You have really concrete ideas about how our government, governments across the globe, can have impact, how industry can have impact. So I want to make sure in our conversation, we drill down on how we're going to realize your vision of making sure that we do have more accessible AI, that we do have more people able to access and benefit from it, and also understanding how that ties into the mission of your current work at SCSP. And if you do realize your goal at SCSP, what will look different in the world?
No, that's a great question, Miriam. I mean, look, if you look back, whether it was fire or electricity or steam engine, these things changed the course of nations. And you had nations that adopted right away these technologies, and you had nations that hesitated, didn't have the right ingredients maybe in place, the right ecosystem, the term we use it today. So if we are in that moment right now, I think the goal of the SCSP would be, have we set our country and our allies and partners or democracies writ large in a path to utilize, build technology around the framework of the values, norms, and the rule of law we have? Have we set up our country and our allies and partners on a path to continue with this innovation ecosystem where the best applications, the best utilization of these technologies come from our societies and our individuals? I think that would be the measurement of success, because if 20 years from now, we look back and say, like, AI is everywhere, but we have built it in a right way that we have maximized the economic prosperity of our citizens. We have adopted in a way that is responsible and ethical. And also we have maximized it for educational purposes, for health benefits. Everything that this technology has right now in its infancy, the promises that it shows. And so I think in 20 years from now, if you look back, is I think I would like to say, yes, we set the right foundations for that future, similarly to what people have done with fire and electricity and steam engine. But this requires whole of nation approach. This requires you working with academia and private sector and government. And I think that's the purpose of the SCSP, is like, how do we bring all these communities together? How do I identify challenges associated with this technology? As you know, Miriam, there will be people that will lose jobs. because of this technology. So how do we reskill, retrain the future workforce? You know, how do we make sure that despite the fact that we have to protect our youngest, we also give them the opportunity to have tailored education, that people have access to this technology in the most rural areas of this country? And I think that is the one thing that we need to highlight as we build the future. And I think, you know, as SDSP, we try to really take that comprehensive whole of nation approach, that looking at the promises, but also challenges of this technology, and why the next, I would argue, 3 to 5 years are really critical in setting the foundation for the future.
Building on those thoughts about your vision, the ultimate goal, your vision is not lost on the leadership around town. People know that you have given a lot of thought and that you're someone to be heard on this topic. And one example is your testimony at the Senate AI Insight Forum on Innovation. And in that testimony, you identified 5 key action areas where you wanted to see Congress act, as you talk about, to maintain American leadership in artificial intelligence. So can you tell us more about how you defined these key action items when looking at the whole global landscape? In your few minutes of testimony, how did you decide that these were the key areas, and what would it look like if they listened to you and Congress enacted the vision that you were talking about?
No, thank you, Miriam. And look, I think what the Senate has done with these AI Insight Forum, they've created a forum where all aspects of our society, academia, private sector, civil society leaders, labor leaders, have come in front of the members of the Senate, of our Senate, and really expressed their opinions about what we need to do as a country to provide some kind of a governance framework around this technology, right? And so I think you could hear the concerns, you can hear the hopes, you can hear all the things in these AI Insight Forum, I think 9 of them that the Senate leadership organized. From our point of view, from the SDSP point of view, there are several elements that I think we have to be focused on. Number one is, how do we get ourselves organized for this new era? And I think if you look traditionally back, every time we faced these kind of a historical moments, that required us to either remission the existing departments and agencies we have, because we're dealing with a new challenge ahead of us. And in that aspect, you know, some of the departments and agencies need new authorities. They need new policies to adapt for this new era, in this case, the AI era. So organizing for this is probably what I recommended in front of the Senate. I also argue that we need additional resources that go towards these new initiatives. Most of the departments and agencies, and Miriam, you know this well, have a handful of people that are dealing with these issues. So they need these departments and agencies, whether it's NIST or National Science Foundation, or, you know, you name it, they need additional resources in terms of people and in terms of money to be able to really set the foundation on how we govern this technology going forward. As you know, we have been a big proponent of the National AI Research Cloud, because I think it provides that testbed for small, medium-sized enterprises, for academia, to have access to these tools and build these new future applications. And I think the NAIR initiative that was launched a while ago by Stanford and a handful of other initiatives that we as NSCI fully endorsed was another point that I made in front of the AI Insight Forum, that it has to be fully funded. When you look back, I think we have argued that in total, over the course of 5 years, NAIR needs $3.4 billion, or I think it comes down to like $400 or $600 million a year. I think this is really a small amount of down payment we can make as a country to really test case how it is to provide this cloud access to small and medium-sized enterprises, to academic enterprises, and really use these tools for the future. So I said organization is really important. Resources are really important. Workforce, education, people really are critical elements of this. I cannot reemphasize enough how important people are for us to, you know, people that exist in private sector, and how we can provide pipelines for them to help our government move forward. I know this is something you have worked on. The second piece is people that already are inside our federal government, and how do you reskill and retrain them for this future? And then the third piece that is near and dear to my heart is, as an immigrant, how do we make sure that America stays a magnet for the world's most talented individuals when they can come They can go to school here. And if they want to, they can stay because they want to contribute to our country. They're studying in some of these cutting edge technologies. And I think we as a country would benefit by having them here. So H-1B is one of those issues that I think we've been talking for a while now. And how do we make sure people that are eligible for that really have the ability to stay?
Well, thank you for sharing that. And I do think one of the exciting things about this moment is thinking about the ways that AI already is helping us and will help us. But I also think it's exciting because, as you've just touched on, I actually don't think we can thrive as a country. We can't continue in leadership. We can't continue to prosper as a democracy unless we do better, unless we make sure that we are more inclusive, that more people are able to participate and benefit from the AI economy in all the ways that we're thinking about, not just all as computer scientists, but all able to thrive, upskill in government and outside of government. And given how much thought you've put into this and how many specific tangible measures you've recommended, I wonder if you had a backup list of things that you were hoping you would also include in the insight form, but given the limits of time, you weren't able to touch on in that testimony as to how you were going to realize this vision we're talking about, where AI does benefit more people, where more people are able to personally enjoy the economic benefits as well as the technical capacities that AI will offer.
No, I mean, thank you, Miriam. I think you're 100% right in your assessment. I would argue that the AI executive order issued by the White House really is a milestone document for us as a country because it really moves our departments and agencies to look at their mission and how they can execute their mission in this new era and how can they expand. So like the positive implications to the rest of the country by adopting this technology. If you look at Department of Transportation, Department of Education, all these departments now have to look at the White House AI EO and say, like, what do I need to do to make sure that we benefit by adopting this technology? What are the safeguards we need to put in place? What kind of issues we have to deal with to make sure that this technology is inclusive and is used in a responsible way? So I think it really sets in motion all those things you mentioned, Miriam, in how to provide equitable benefits to all our citizens. Now, I think also living in 2023 and 24 gives us the benefit of looking backwards and seeing what models worked and what models didn't work. And I think we can try now to make it better. You know, did we fail in not providing clear safeguards when the social media emerged? I think so. And so I think now we're at a different point as a society because we have seen, we have learned from the past. And I think the White House CEO goes really to that extent to acknowledge that, hey, these are now the opportunities, but in order for us to get to these opportunities, we have to be careful how we do it. We have to make sure we have the right policies and safeguards in place that we don't cause more harm than benefit by adopting this technology. So I think that's the first piece I think, Miriam, we can do. I think Congress really can play an incredible role here. I think any piece of legislation that I think will result from the AI Insight Forum, I'm hoping it would have a holistic approach in how we legislate and how we provide some kind of a governance structure around this technology. But as an immigrant, I'm always a half glass full guy. I believe in American experiment. I really believe that America really is that country that continuously improves and it changes and adopts and, you know, acknowledges its own mistakes and then tries to make it better. So are we going to get some things wrong? Probably, Miriam. But I think if we focus our energy in really trying to do the right thing, I think by the end of this decade, maybe we will be positioned that our model of AI will win over the alternative model, which is not something that we want our kids to grow up. Primarily, it's a model driven by autocracy regime out of Beijing. And now Beijing and Moscow and North Korea and Iran have so like created a informal coalition of pushing back against our model of democracies that we project with our allies and partners. And so I think that is the assessment we have to make in by 2030 is like how we did between now and then, what kind of model we build around AI, and did that model win over time against the alternative model that is being built outside of our model?
Well, and pulling the thread on one of the modeled infrastructure pieces that you talked about, the president's executive order on safe, secure, and trustworthy development and use of artificial intelligence, which we call the AIEO. People can read your blog if they want to learn more of your thoughts on the EO in particular in a post last November. And you mentioned how it serves a key role in upgrading the government and making sure they're AI ready and ready for this time and this moment. So not too much of a surprise, perhaps, that you're a fan, because your fingerprints are clearly all over it, both from NSCAI recommendations that were incorporated in the EO, your work on NIAC that was part of the recommendations and the orders that we now see in the executive order, which mandates, I believe, over 150 action items to over 50 federal agencies. But I would love your thoughts 6 months in. Where do you see the next steps? Where are there gaps, or where are there important pieces to follow up on to ensure that we continue to realize the impact that you're hoping the executive order achieves?
Yeah, so Miriam, I think two points that that newsletter point to, and I highlighted at the AI Insight Forum, is in the near term, I think two actions that I would really like that we undertake is, number one is, we have elections coming up in November. And not just us, but as you know, most of the democratic world is going through some form of elections, whether it's EU, India just finished their elections, Taiwan finished their elections. So how can we position ourselves so this technology is not misused for the purposes of these milestone event for our democracies? So I think that was my call to action for, like, even if we cannot pass any meaningful legislation this year because of the political cycle, because of the other pressing issues, how do we make sure that our departments and agencies have robust authorities and robust policies in place to safeguard our democratic institutions as we go through this process? Across the democracies, these are probably the most important elections this decade. If you are our adversary, I think this is a key moment for you to work against, you know, our social cohesion, to create doubts about our systems, our values, and our norms. And so how can we have some kind of a safeguards in place that they are not misusing this technology against us? That was my first call to action. The second one was really, like, as we debate, and I know you've played an important role in the space, how do we govern this technology? I think one of the points we made in that newsletter and then the AI Insight Forum is, we have to focus on high consequence cases. By the time we have a fulsome, wholesome governance regulatory piece that addresses all the issues, I think in the near term, we can identify high consequence cases that this technology might impact. And so how do we provide some kind of a safeguard for the groups, individuals, you know, ethnicities, to be protected against misuse of this technology? So those were, like, my two immediate, like, short-term, I think, actions that I recommended, because I thought we will uncover more as we go along and people start adopting more and more of this technology. But the most impactful policies, or I would argue most impactful milestones that we have ahead of us, are the elections and probably the issue of technology not being used to create more harm in these cases.
Yeah. And to follow up on that point, you last year at STSP published a year in review memorandum on the state of AI, and you gave some predictions for 2024. Again, a testament to how quickly the world is moving, that we already seem to be looking way back in December as many years ago for the state of AI, the state of the world. But you had one section entitled "Geopolitics Are Back Again." So I'm curious, you've talked about elections across the global stage. Do you think that right now, in particular, we're giving enough time and attention to the dynamic between the US and China competition? And do you currently expect that this will be part of your 2025 predictions, or any others you would like to premise here, and that we can start to think about what you will be predicting at the end of 2025?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Miriam, a lot of things have changed, I think, I would argue, since we started SCSP. And I worry a lot of things have moved in a wrong direction in sort of, like, the geopolitical security environment. You have the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which led to, you know, massive tragedies, both for people of Ukraine, I'm sure you traveled to Europe. I traveled to Europe, but like, this is the biggest war in European continent since World War II. And you can see it, you can feel it, you can, when you talk to the people, I mean, they're directly impacted. There are waves of refugees coming out of Ukraine, either, you know, going through Poland or the rest of Europe. But I think the security environment has changed dramatically, Miriam, since, you know, you and I worked together at NIAC and we started SCSP. So that's one thing. The second thing that I would argue is the security environment has also deteriorated in the Middle East since October 7th, as you know. And so I worry that 2025, 2030, and this is sort of like our mission statement is, 2025, 2030 can be a really challenging period for us and for democracies around the world, because you have this deteriorating security environment. You have China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran. So like much, much closely aligning their goals and their policies against us and against the democracies. We are now in April of 2024, and we see articles of China aiding and assisting Russian efforts in Ukraine. And so my prediction, I think it's more grim than I would, that I'm generally very optimistic by nature, but like I worry that 2025, 2030 really will be a challenging period. And not to go back to history, but like there are many moments in history. There was a piece that I read recently says that, you know, World War II is known that started from, like officially was 4 years from 41 to 45. But most of these small conflicts started in the late 30s. And so I don't want to make that kind of a historical analogy with where we live today, but I really believe that how we position ourselves, how we get ourselves organized, how we move fast in getting ahead in these technologies, both from the adoption, but also in terms of governance, could really set the course for the rest of this century. And unfortunately, the security environment is not very promising in that aspect, because we see daily how much things have changed globally. And so if I would make a grim prediction, is that I hope that in 2025, all the elements that are promising from this side, and there are many elements, you know, despite the environment we live in, you know, we still live in a country that has checks and balances. We still live in a country that has the best economy that has rebounded since COVID. We have still the best military force in the world, and we still have the best innovation ecosystem in the world. So like those are the positive elements, but we're also facing an increasing challenging security environment globally. So how do we as a country come together to face these challenges? I think will matter a lot. Elections are generally never a good test for this, but I hope that in 2025, you and I will start the year with like a new moment and national unification in which we understand that the challenges ahead of us are much, much bigger than the issues that are dividing us. And then we position ourselves for those 5 years that we as SCSP have argued are going to be really, really difficult, and will set the course for the rest of the century.
Well, I appreciate your not sugarcoating. You're telling us your concerns, your fears for how things can play out if we don't take the right action steps, the concrete developments in government and outside of government at this poignant moment. But I do think people can take comfort in the fact that we are fortunate that you are very clear and you speak in very practical ways, giving white papers, giving very concrete steps. And you have an audience all across the globe and particularly within our government. So I hope our listeners are hearing you as to the importance of this moment, the high stakes, high consequence, but can also take some comfort in the fact that many people are hearing you and will be taking action as a result of some of the proposals you've outlined here and in other places. And in thinking about some of the concrete steps you're taking to make sure we have impact, we move forward in important ways, I want to make sure we talk about the AI Expo for National Competitive that you are having come to the DC stage for the first time, May 7th and May 8th. And Equal AI is proud to be participating in the Responsible AI Innovation panel and thread that you'll be convening as part of the AI Expo. And again, a testament to your vision that responsible AI innovation has a part, a thread, an important piece of this AI Expo. So tell us more. What are you hoping to achieve? What was the original purpose? And how will the world look different at the end of the Expo if you have your way?
No, thanks, Miriam. And thanks for your partnership for the AI Expo. On one of the most important panels we're going to have over the course of 2 days, I think our objectives were really clear. We wanted to be a group of individuals that not only write and provide these recommendations and policies, but we really put our money where our mouth is. And we've argued for quite some time that our country needs a new public-private model of partnerships. And I think there's no better way than bringing together in DC some of the key innovators from private sector, some of the key academic leaders, university labs, government labs, departments and agencies in one place over the course of 2 days where they can talk, they can share experiences, they can continue their collaboration. Because I think there's so much energy and there's so much innovation happening in private sector, not just on AI, but on bio, quantum, you name it, right? That I believe that the only way for us to move forward is to provide that space where everybody from private sector, academia, and government comes together and over the course of 2 days engages in richful conversations, listens to incredible speakers, walks around the hall, and they meet exhibitors. We have over 150 exhibitors on the floor of the convention center. And you have small, medium-sized companies to large companies. You have university labs. You have state and local offices that are putting money into innovation and emerging tech. And so we really wanted to create the ecosystem here in DC where you can come, you can participate in these conversations, you can listen to keynote speakers, decision makers, and really create that environment that moves us forward in this era.
Well, we are really excited for DC to experience this first of its kind AI expo here and applaud you for what I know is no small task. Listen, I am so grateful that everyone listening today and everyone who listens to you on all the different medium you participate in and read all the work that you put out are able to benefit from the deep insights you have on this space and the personal commitment you have made to ensuring that America is AI ready and that more of us, hopefully all of us, are able to participate, enjoying safety and security, as well as the health and so many numerous benefits that AI will offer. Thank you, Ily, for sharing your insights with us today. And thank you for all the work you are doing to help us achieve that vision.
Thank you for having me, Miriam.
You've just listened to In AI We Trust, hosted by Miriam Vogel of Equal AI and me, Kay Firth Butterfield from the World Economic Forum. Subscribe to or download our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. We always welcome your feedback. And if you like the podcast, please rate us or give us a review. To learn more or get involved, visit us at www.equalai.org and www.weforum.org.
And a special thanks to NP Agency, without whom this podcast would not be possible. Thank you for your editing, producing, and all-around support for the In AI We Trust podcast.